And welcome to Conversations with the Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Vikram Amar, Dean and Ewan Foundation Professor of Law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Amar was on campus to serve as the keynote for the law school's annual Arkansas Law Review Symposium and to discuss his research on state and federal constitutions.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. I wanted to start out, the symposium is on state constitutional law. You are one of the experts in this field. How did you come to this field of study?
Well, I actually started my academic career focusing on the U.S. Constitution, and I still do. That's probably where the majority, the bulk of my academic work lies, is in the federal Constitution. But the more one gets into the federal Constitution, the more one has to understand state counterparts for two reasons. One is there's a big movement in law generally these days to be what we call comparative.
Okay.
That is to compare how one system answers certain questions to how other systems do it. Mm-hmm. And most comparative law has an international focus to it. So if you just meet someone and they say, I teach comparative law, they're typically going to be comparing American law to the law of China or the law of Brazil or other countries. But it turns out we have a lot of fertile comparative law ground here in the United States with regard to the Constitution, because we have 50 separate state constitutions plus the federal constitution. Mm-hmm. And every state does things a little bit differently, and we can learn both across states and at the federal level from what states have been doing.
Okay, so it's really fulfilling the founders' laboratory of democracy, so to speak, at a constitutional level.
That's right. One of the values of having both state and federal governments, it is often said, is that states can conduct policy experiments from which other states and the federal government can learn. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when we think about those policy experiments, we think about laws that state legislatures have passed or policies that governors have enacted. Mm-hmm. But what's true for ordinary legislation is also true for constitutions. So seeing which states decide to enshrine which kinds of things in their constitution, seeing which states make it easy or hard to change their constitution in various ways, those are also experiments from which other states and the national government can learn if they are attentive. There are a lot of justifications for having separate state governments apart from the federal government. One, for example, is that the states can blow the whistle on the feds when the feds are overreaching. Mm-hmm. But another often cited reason why we have a very complex and sometimes confusing marbled system of American democracy is the notion you were adverted to, the idea that states can conduct policy experiments and can do them in localized ways so that if the experiment goes awry, the whole country doesn't have to bear the costs of that. And if the experiment turns out to be a good one, then other states and the federal government can learn from that. So that the experimental laboratory value of federalism is one that's often cited. Most of the time when we talk about that, we think about statutes that state legislatures pass or policies that governors try to announce. Sure. But what's true for ordinary statutes is also true for the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The fact that different states do different things within their constitutions and make their constitutions easier or harder to change also generate lessons for the rest of us.
That makes sense. I think in studying this field, it would be difficult to keep up if you've got, you know, the federal constitution and another 50 or 51 if you include the District of Columbia. I assume they have a constitution.
They have a charter of sorts.
It seems like there's always something new happening. How fluent do you feel like you are with all of that, or do you have certain specialties in certain states?
That's a great question, and I would be the first to admit I am not nearly as knowledgeable about state constitutionalism in a lot of states and even parts of the country. I spent most of my career before moving to the University of Illinois last summer as a law professor within the University of California system, and I grew up in California. And so I'm very versant with a lot of cutting-edge California constitutional issues. It just so happens that California and the West are very interesting places to study state constitutionalism, in part because the Western states tend to make more use of direct democracy devices, popular initiatives, recalls, and the like, referenda. And California has actually been a leader, kind of a trendsetter in a lot of direct democracy movements going back to the 1960s and 70s. Okay. And those really pose a lot of the crispest state constitutional law questions. Not the only ones, but some really interesting ones.
I was going to ask about a few years ago, there was a lot on social media about Proposition 8. A bunch of celebrities got involved. There were, you know, avatars for Facebook. Can you elaborate on any of that?
Yeah, Proposition 8 was one of a number of state constitutional amendments that banned same-sex marriage. So California did this by a voter initiative, and they did it the same day that Barack Obama was elected president in 2008. So it was a kind of an odd juxtaposition. California went overwhelmingly for Obama, and the same night the voters adopted Prop 8.
Wow.
And the political dynamics behind Prop 8 were very complicated. The Mormon Church gave a lot of money in favor of Prop 8. The sponsors of Prop 8 were a somewhat unrepresentative group of individuals who wanted to keep marriage to a man and a woman for particular reasons, not necessarily the reasons that other people might want to limit marriage to one man, one woman.
Right.
Proposition 8 was challenged in the state courts and in the federal courts. And when it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the governor and the attorney general of the state of California declined to defend the law passed by the people of California.
Wow.
So we had this odd situation where people were challenging the law, but the government that ordinarily defends its laws said, we agree with the challengers.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the Supreme Court said there's no way to hear the case because no one can really step in to defend the law. It raised all kinds of complicated wrinkles in law. Ultimately, it got resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court holding in cases from other states that there's a federal right to same-sex marriage.
Okay. That procedure, is that how unique is that in you know, nationwide,
yeah,
that it goes all the way up the chain like that for some constitutional issue?
So the Supreme Court only hears fewer than 100 cases a year. But a lot of recent cases the Supreme Court has heard have actually involved popular initiatives from states. So the Prop 8 case is one. There was a case involving Michigan's Proposal 2, which was a voter-initiated change that banned race-based affirmative action in universities and other entities in the state of Michigan. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. Just last year, the voters of Arizona took the job of drawing district lines for congressional districts out of the elected state legislature's hands because the voters were concerned that there was too much partisan and other gerrymandering going on, and they created an independent citizens commission. The state legislature, the elected legislature, sued the state, oddly enough, saying the people can't take this power away from us because the federal constitution gives this to us, the elected legislature. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. That's just three examples of how these direct democracy, state constitutional innovations pose cutting edge issues.
That makes sense. It's complicated.
It sure is.
It's a quagmire.
State constitutionalism and direct democracy, which is a distinctive feature of some state constitutions, they present exciting possibilities for really great reform. But from some people's perspectives, they also make it easy to do a lot of bad, to do damage, in part because you know, the initiatives that make the ballot and that pass aren't always the grassroots ones that you think of when you watch movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. A lot of these are industry driven, and money is a big factor in what gets enacted.
Dean Amar, you are here for a symposium as the keynote speaker, but also four panel discussions. The title of it is State Constitutional Change, Traditions, Trends, and Theory. And I just wanted to get an idea of some of your thoughts on this. And as we speak, the symposium is still to come. So what you think, maybe some of the topics?
Well, I think it's an exciting symposium. It's the brainchild of one of the faculty members here at the University of Arkansas Law School, and also another bright young scholar from Boston College. And they came together and they invited a number of really high quality, productive scholars who are experts on various aspects of state constitutionalism to come talk. So some of the topics that are going to be taken up include direct democracy, which is something you and I spoke about a little earlier, and whether that is going to flourish or whether that's going to contract.
Okay.
How hard it is for state constitutions to be amended, formally or informally, compared to the federal constitution and compared to constitutions of other countries. I'm going to talk about the interplay between state constitutional change and federal constitutional change.
Okay.
It turns out that oftentimes, and maybe increasingly so, we alter the meaning of the federal constitution through means that originate at the state constitutional level. So it's kind of a two-step process. Other people are doing some historical analysis of early state constitutions and identifying some under-noticed trends in them. So it's a very diverse intellectual group of people, but they have in common a sophisticated approach to this important topic.
Well, and others who are going to be involved are some state legislators and some retired members of the state
judiciary.
Of the state Supreme Court or Court of Appeals. And what do you think they'll add to the discussion?
Well, I'm not sure specifically what they'll say, because I haven't seen they didn't produce paper drafts like some of the professors have.
Right.
But in general, I think they will likely talk about the dynamics they saw when they were on a court or in a legislature, and they will add an important perspective that's often missing in these academic conferences.
Right.
We law professors like to write about a lot of things that may make sense theoretically and that sound good. But it's always important that we engage people in the field. And so I think it's a really unusual and great feature of this conference that it's bringing people from both worlds to talk to each other.
Kind of see how the rubber meets the road, so to speak.
Exactly.
Have you participated in other similar symposia?
I have participated in symposia that focused on particular aspects of particular state constitutions. This is the first one I think I can remember that really looks at the dynamics and processes and structures of constitutional change at the state level in a comparative and historical setting.
That's great. I know everyone at the School of Law is really excited to get it started, and we're honored to have you here leading the discussion. One of the things we like to do with this particular podcast is talk a little bit about how professors got into doing what they're doing. Some people have a very clear path very early on. Some people stumble into it. So I know your bachelor's degree is in history, and then you went to get your JD. What took you down the path of deciding to teach and to teach what you decided to teach?
Good questions. I did not know I wanted to be a professor when I started law school. But by the time I left law school, I knew that I would probably try to do it if I got a job that I liked. I was really turned on intellectually by my years at Yale Law School. I loved reading academic scholarship about the law that I was learning. Constitutional law was a field that dovetailed nicely with the American history focus I had in college. Yes. I also had a very unusual background because my older brother was a law professor at Yale, and he started there on the faculty the year I started there as a student.
Oh, that's
so my 3 years of law school, I kind of saw what the life of a young law professor was like. So when I graduated from law school and I was able to clerk for a couple of federal judges, including one of the Supreme Court justices, which opened a lot of doors for me, I decided I would try to teach. But I also knew that I wanted to practice for a while in between.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of law professors are professors who happen to have a JD. I'm not that way. I am an academic lawyer, but I really take seriously my ties to the profession. And all of the academic work I do, I like to think would be of interest to lawyers and judges and not just other academics.
That's great. So how do you feel your history degree served you as you were, well, now as a professor and as a dean and as a practitioner?
Well, I think, you know, different areas of law are going to draw on different disciplines. In constitutional law, it's hard not to have some either background or at least interest in history,
mm-hmm.
because history really informs the way the Constitution came about and how it's been interpreted. You know, if I were teaching contract law or tort law, I'm not sure that my American history expertise in college would have played nearly as significant a role. But I studied a lot. I took a lot of classes at Berkeley with some of the world's greatest historians, not just of the early American history, but also of the mid-19th century American history, the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like Ken Stamp and Leon Litwack. These were, you know, some of the biggest names in Civil War and Reconstruction history. And it turns out that a lot of the constitutional issues that I focus on, not all of them, but a lot of them, have to do with the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments that came about after the Civil War. So that background really has helped me in my scholarship and my teaching, less so as a dean. As a dean, I'm not sure that history is relevant, other than you have to learn the lessons of the past.
That's a good point.
And try to avoid making mistakes that you made before.
Which is a good lesson for a dean.
Yes.
Or any administrator.
Yes.
Many undergrads, when they're considering law school, they ask around the law school, what should I major in as an undergrad? Do you have any advice for them?
You know, as I suggested a moment ago, I think there are a lot of disciplines that are helpful to legal thinking and a legal career. As a general matter, I think having some history, some American history, is good because American law is very culturally grounded. And so you have to have some understanding of how American culture got to be where it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think having some background in economics is helpful. There are a lot of areas of law that make use of economic analysis. Psychology is an area that might be good to have a little bit of fluency. But beyond that, I think you should major in something that really interests you,
mm-hmm.
where you can immerse yourself, do your best, show off, really get engaged. You know, math majors, physics majors, engineers make great lawyers just as political scientists and historians and econ majors do. The only thing I would say, though, is if you do major in a field that is not one that requires you to write a lot,
mm-hmm.
then you have to take it upon yourself to do a lot of writing and expose yourself to writing requirements, because writing is the stock and trade of lawyers, and you have to be good with the written word to be an excellent lawyer in almost every area of practice or the academy.
Your scholarly writing is prolific. I was looking at your CV, and it just goes on and on and on, and there are written books and edited books and, you know, symposia like this one and refereed articles. Do you have a form of academic writing that you prefer? Or is, you know, short form, long form?
Interesting question. I would say that when I started 25 years ago after law school, most legal scholarship that was most highly valued took the form of longer, ponderous law review articles that were not as accessible to a wide audience. Nowadays, with technology having changed and the internet becoming so important, it's very helpful to get your ideas out more quickly. And these law review articles often take over a year from start to finish to produce. Yeah. So legal scholarship has, I think, happily moved in the direction of embracing some shorter pieces as well as the longer pieces. Turns out a lot of the longer pieces are filler.
Yes.
And you can really get your idea out there in 20 pages if you're economical with your words. Legal law scholarship has also moved in the direction of co-authorship, which I think is a good thing because many heads are often better than one, and moved in the direction of interdisciplinary work.
Okay.
So combining historical work, economic work, and legal work sometimes gives a fuller picture than just a purely legal perspective. So I think all of those are really good developments. One thing I try to do is to supplement my academic writing with writing that is designed to be read by non-lawyers about legal topics. So I write a column every 2 weeks for a prominent legal website called Justia.com on constitutional matters. And I write what I hope are sophisticated constitutional ideas, but I present them in a way that I intend for an intelligent AP high school student or college student to be able to understand. Because if they can't understand what the Constitution is about, then we're not really doing our job. The Constitution exists for the people, and for that to work, the people have to be able to understand and know about it.
Yeah. If the average voter can't comprehend it, we're in a lot of trouble.
That's exactly right.
Well, that makes sense. What about the even shorter forms that are happening now, things like SCOTUS blog? And do you ever do any writing for that?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with people
sure.
who do?
Yeah, I've written for SCOTUS blog. Typically they want 800 words, whereas my biweekly columns may be 2,000 to 3,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a place for all of it. Mm-hmm. You cannot do justice to some topics in 800 words. You can begin to introduce some important themes, but sometimes you need a few thousand. Sometimes you need 10,000 or 15,000.
Right.
Rarely do you need 50,000, although sometimes you do.
Right.
So I think what's good about the world we have today is that you have a lot more options as a reader. And depending on who you are and what you want to get out of it, let's say you want to know a little bit about a Supreme Court case that's being argued or being decided this year.
Mm-hmm.
You can read a SCOTUS blog summary of the case and get a fair amount. You could read an online essay I wrote and get, I hope, a little bit more depth.
Right.
Or you could read a law review article and really feel like you're penetrating deeply and understanding all the nuance.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you're not somebody who's going to be in the business, maybe you don't need to read that article.
Yeah. It also seems helpful in that there are so many competing ideas of what things in the Constitution mean, and that gives the he said, she said, so to speak.
It's easier to be exposed to the wide array of legitimate perspectives in today's internet world. The only thing I would add to that, though, is sometimes there's so much stuff out there that you don't stumble on the good stuff because there's a lot of bad stuff out there.
Yeah.
And you get bogged down in that. So I really do think that sophisticated readers need to make use of good shortcut cues to figure out where the best places to get the good analysis are. Because just because it's on a site doesn't mean that it's well thought through or is coming from someone who knows what she or he is talking about.
Makes sense. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Music for Conversations with the Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. For more information and additional podcasts, go to kuaf.com or law.uark.edu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, on Stitcher, or with your favorite podcast app. Follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.